Paula, thank you very much. Can I very much acknowledge and express my appreciation to the traditional owners on whose land I have spent many months in working through the culmination of this report. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and especially also to emerging leaders. Can I also use this occasion to simply say thank you? The Minister, I think, has given you the very clear mandate and also indicated that he had the wholehearted support of Cabinet for the recommendations and enduring directions of this report. That, to me, signifies his confidence in both the quality, the depth, and the scope of the feedback that we received through the consultations. So individually, collectively, this is your report, and on behalf of the panel, I want to thank you for your input. It is unbelievable. We could not have done it on the eastern side, so you've got one over us on that side. So thank you. Can I also acknowledge the panel members who are in the audience who may wish to stand? Michael Barnes, come on, he hates it, so I'm doing it. Warren Harding, Meredith, who's known to you all, Pip, Hannah. Could I also acknowledge Russ, who's known to you all more often than not through the media, probably, and also ask the Secretariat members to stand up. This has been a mammoth effort. We've had some pretty robust discussions, but they've been a superb group to work with, and we are very much in their debt. Thank you very much. As I exercised this morning, I got this wormweed of a song going through my mind, Etta James, which is At Last, and you can actually understand why that was humming through my mind. I want to use my sort of very short session just to skip you through the report. Nothing will take away the need for you to actually have a look at the recommendations and the substance of the report in more detail, but you have before you actually the eight enduring strategies and the 30 recommendations the Minister referred to. I thought that was pivotal. I want to just quickly just remind you of the case for change, which we outlined in some detail in the interim report. You basically told us we didn't go hard enough, look closer in a lot of areas, and you were right. So the final report very much does justice to those issues. So just to skip through them, one of the most significant ones is you are here at the end of the day in professional capacities, but equally at the end of the day, you like me, at certain points in your life, will have to rely on the health system and its various partners, and you will experience some of the frustrations and fragmentations and low met expectations that we heard through our review. That is the major driver of change. The fact that there's not one of us that will not be reliant on the health system and its associated services and social care services. So ultimately, you as users of the system will be the major agents of change. Can I also say, and I want to acknowledge Pip's role here in the work of the Consumer and Carer Reference Group, stop using the word patient. I've never seen myself as a patient, even in my worst moments, and ultimately, we are all people who rely on the health system. So that was a very clear message, but this is a very strong message about the role of people using the system having a say in going forward. Growth and demand. The Minister's touched on them. They are scary. One in two of us have some sort of chronic issue. Too many of us carry weight, frighteningly so. The generation coming behind of us, one in four have weight issues. Those issues are really massively concerning when you've got the forward trajectories. The growth in demand, you've got about 1 million people turning up in your emergency departments at the moment per year. That's frightening. That's a 49% increase on the past. You've got those stats. Can I say Commonwealth investment? I look around and basically state health systems at the moment, it's state taxpayers that are actually funding the bulk of state health services. So I think the rationale underpinning the Sustainable Health Review was that it really has to be driven by you, understood by you, and in effect, the mandate to continue reform has to come from the community as a whole because the state is the major funder of the health services at the moment. And every health jurisdiction at the state level, nationally or internationally, is focusing very much on sustainability. Health insurance. You as a state, I think, have got the highest number of private health insurance users, but that's also an issue that's changing, and John no doubt will touch on that on his session as well. Out-of-pocket expenses was a major issue in our consultations and came up many times. Population health. I think we gave a very detailed analysis in our interim report about some of the challenges. It's frightening that now 73% of people die of some sort of chronic disorder. That's an indication of the fact that the health services and hospital system that was built in the past needs to change to deal with the lifestyle disorders that we now are actually manifesting more frequently. Whole range of population health issues. Partnerships. I had Chris Hall just come up to me before I got on the stage, cheeky bugger, and said, is it ambitious enough? Have you actually done enough to make sure that there is an incentive for people in this room to partner as opposed to actually dealing with an issue very much from the provider perspective or where they stand from a professional perspective? I hope so, and certainly they are some of the drivers and the input that we've received from groups like WACOS, which have been superb, the very embedded partnership we've had with WAFA during the preparation of our report, and the very significant input we've had from groups such as the Aboriginal Controlled Health Organisations, the Mental Health Commission. We have tried to anchor so many issues that make partnership a necessary way of going forward, no longer an optional extra. I don't like the term digital disruption. I think it's digital opportunity. You know, it's one of the most significant gaps between people's expectations and the delivery of the current system. There is absolutely no doubt that the digital maturity of an agency will be a large determinant on whether care is safe, whether someone who uses the health system has access to data, whether you're actually meeting their expectations about data linking, but ultimately a whole range of the efficiency issues as well. New treatments, ministers touched on those, social determinants of health. It is well known how important having a safe home to be in is in relation to any outcomes. Doesn't matter what sphere of government you work in, all roads tend to lead to housing. So there's clearly a necessary acknowledgement of that. Value-based care. Most of us, like myself, might have had an arthroscopy that didn't work out to be all that successful. Very pleased to read subsequently it wasn't of any value. Cost me a lot of money of out-of-pocket care. But that's an indication, basically, of the fact that we really do need to ensure that we focus on high-value care, stuff that makes a difference, stuff that's actually going to have a benefit both for the person receiving it, but also arguably for you as taxpayers. Evidence-based, value-based care is a direction that's being pursued across the board. Transparency. Professor Hugo Massey-Taylor, and I really applaud his appointment, it's an excellent appointment, made it quite clear this is an area where WA lags. You don't have access to the data that you, as users of the system, would like to see, but also which is so pivotal to driving change. Brief summation. Pillars to sustainability. That's just a reminder that this is not just all about money. Quite clearly, we, I think, have adopted the very much accepted international model of looking at four pillars. Patient experience. We are, particularly the baby boomers, a particularly annoying, difficult, demanding generation. And we are in the instance most often that we're actually looking after aged family members and friends, and also looking after grandchildren. So we're bridging many generations and we're living longer. But patient experience at the moment and the experience of people who use the system is the bridge in the absence of other better technology to actually ensure that the acute system links effectively with the primary healthcare system. Quality, safety and population health. One of the major functions of a health system is to actually leave you in a better state than it's found you. Quality and safety is pivotal in going forward and always has to be one of the anchors. Improvements in health outcomes. Sadly, too often, hospital or health systems are judged on the number of beds. You know yourself that ultimately it is about keeping people well. It's about having supports and services which are not always clinical, but having the confidence that you have access to clinical, good clinical and safe clinical services when you need them. Cost and waste reduction. Obviously you'd expect that. The efficiency issues are significant and there are opportunities for waste. Often the issues that annoy clinicians the most are the ones that annoy you most as users of the system as well. Finally, staff engagement. This document has been very much informed by practitioner as well as evidence base. It acknowledges those providing the service are closest to it and also in most instances know well and truly what things need to change. They are the pillars of sustainability. Can I get you to turn to your little one-pager on the desk now? I'm not going to ask you to hold hands, but you'll focus on the document on this basis. The Minister was very keen for you actually to see the depth of the recommendations beneath the enduring strategies. What do we mean by enduring strategies? Quite simply, Minister's talked about a rebalancing. He's talked about a long-term plan. He's talked about the fact that this will take a series of steps. No one in this room can individually actually ensure that there is a sustainable health system. That point's been made well and truly. We debated at some length, took best counsel, heard so many views from such experienced users of the system and practitioners. These eight were the ones that we came up. The issues that led to their identification won't change with change of governments. So we've been quite clear in the report that these directions should be enduring strategies and directions because the problems won't change depending on the government in power. So they are written with the hope that they receive bipartisan support. Why eight? Well, you could pick any, but we tried to get it as tight as possible. They fit the WA set of challenges, but they also align with very much what the best health systems in the world are doing. You are incredibly lucky, on one hand, that born in a country that's got such a good health system, but you're also in a health system that knows that it can and needs to do better, and I think that's its most powerful driver for change. All right, we've got 30 recommendations. Can I just run you through the rationale so there's time for questions? The first one, as the Minister has indicated, is to basically pick and stick in relation to some of your most significant public health issues. We heard consistently money goes up and down in these areas. The standard of proof is harder to get money in these areas. Very strong agreement from every expert and Consumer and Carer Forum is obesity and alcohol abuse are really fundamental issues. You have such a proud history of achievement in smoking. The issue is to apply that same rigour, that consistency, pick and stick in those two areas. I really welcome, can I say, I've got a bit teary in terms of seeing the government's preparedness to increase the investment. It is pretty shocking when you only hear there's 1.6 invested in prevention in the health system of the size of the ones that we're used to. So the government's commitment wholeheartedly to increase that investment and to identify key areas is quite significant. Behind number one enduring strategy comes two basic principles. Chronic illness is not an inevitability. Secondly, health inequity is not an inevitability. We focus very clearly on the fact, focus on those members of the community that don't enjoy the right postcode, don't enjoy the background that's given them access to good care at all points of life. Those issues that have led to some quite disturbing and continuing health inequities. So that focus is an enduring one and we have some specific recommendations. Can I also say we have hardwired in the concept of consumer and carer engagement throughout all aspects of the strategy, and this is quite fundamental, as I've indicated. Number five, can I say, was driven and is totally owned and sensibly owned by the health system. You spend roughly over 60 million, if not more, on electricity and water in the health system. You're one of the major sources of single-use plastics and the like, and the public health clinicians argued very coherently that health needs to lead by example. Health produces between 7 to 10% of emissions, so these strategies very much align with Minister Dawson's recently announced commitments in relation to waste reduction, but also looking at climate change mitigations. Can I touch on enduring strategy number two? I also want to acknowledge the work of Tim Marnie and the Mental Health Commission and how pivotal they have been in shaping our recommendations. This is the issue that troubled the panel most significantly. One, because there is such a rising demand in these areas. One in five of us every year will experience an incident of mental illness, and one in two of us at one point in our life will either experience it or be the carer of someone who's experiencing it. The waiting times in emergency departments are shocking, and I welcome the government's recent announcement. You've got 90% of people that wait for more than 15 hours to receive what is a care in an ED acute situation. No one thinks that's acceptable, and there's a real push within the health system to actually look at improving the connections between the acute system, the community system, to rebalance, to build up capacity in the community system, but to recognise that this is an area where interdisciplinary work is really critical, where there a change in behaviour is quite critical, and we've put forward some suggestions which build on the work that's underway so far. Can I also touch quite briefly on number three? People have said, why have you got the beginning in life and end of life together in one enduring strategy? Because that's the lives we lead, folks. There was not a single meeting that discussions didn't come up about the significance of end-of-life discussions. You know, people were concerned that as soon as they enter into an emergency situation, our clinical folk have the responsibility to treat, to care and to treat. So there were some amazing discussions facilitated by Pip and Hannah about how, in effect, what could be done to actually give people more choice, more independence, more dignity in end-of-life discussions. We supported the recommendations from your parliamentary inquiry in that regard, one example being the greater use of advanced care directives, but more significantly encouraging community conversations and also family conversations. At the moment, over 70% of people would prefer to die in their own home, but at the moment, about in the early, I think 61% die in hospital, and that's not normally the choice people would choose to make. So hence that area being flagged. The first 1,000 years, such a totally convincing return on investment case. I've seen amazing changes in New South Wales where they've gone from a focus initially on 1,000 to the first 1,000 days to the first 2,000 days, and it's been so pivotal in driving partnerships, co-location of services, true cooperation at the local government level, true cooperation across the education spectrum. But can I say in WA, such a necessary issue given some of the concerns you have in relation to the potential impacts of alcohol abuse, but also because of the great gains that can be made in investment in this area. Enduring strategy number four, the patient-centred, equitable, seamless access. I really do want to acknowledge what a significant input WAFA has made to these discussions. This is all about getting the acute system to work better with the primary healthcare system. I've seen some amazing research in WA by your own clinicians that have identified the number of occasions of service that can actually be provided better in the community, and an estimate of something like 190,000 people who currently attend emergency departments would actually be able to receive more appropriate care in the community, and they probably would have that preference if that was made available. So those numbers are quite disturbing. This is ultimately an area where, despite the fact that there are obviously always strong sectional and professional interests in health, people landed on one page. The focus on chronic and complex individuals, vulnerable individuals, cannot rely on any one part of the system in operation. There was a very strong consensus about the need that things needed to happen differently to provide wraparound services. There was a very strong recognition that we tend to actually operate within two or three big systems. You tend to be in the aged care system at the same time as you are in the healthcare system, and also potentially in the disability service system too. People were overwhelmed by the complexity. So what they were looking at were basically opportunities to have different models of care, different approaches that are truly person-friendly, safe, high quality, but also economically efficient. At the moment, we can't say that that's necessarily the case in all areas, but can I say the report identifies some amazing opportunities and some excellent models that are already being pursued in Western Australia. This area focuses also specifically on some specific recommendation on improving access to services, particularly for regional and rural patients, talks about the introduction of different practices to improve coordination, to improve the interaction between the parts of the current delivery system, but it is built very much on the fact that this is about behaviour change and not one that can be fixed by a structural fit or, in effect, an investment in infrastructure. This is ultimately culture and this is behavioural, the change required in these areas. I won't go through each and every recommendation because they're for you. This is fundamentally one of the most significant enduring strategies and also the recommendations attached. The final four enduring strategies focus very much on the things that need to change, the enabling strategies. What do we need to do different in relation to the operation of the system, the focus? Number five focuses on driving quality, safety and value through transparency, funding and planning. I mean, what was quite clear and is well understood by the many health professionals in the system At the moment, the incentives almost encourage more activity in an acute setting, despite the fact that there's every factor about a person's preference, about appropriate care being offered in other sectors that would suggest that different models need to be pursued. It also focuses on the importance of health being given the flexibility, the agility to be able to invest, to reinvest, and in some instances to divest in areas where care isn't valuable. And I go back to a very simple example on the arthroscopies. These have to be clinically led decisions, but these have to be decisions and discussions that are made in concert with the people experiencing the care. I smile now when I go into a hospital system and you're actually given a series of options and the risks are discussed with you. And also the costing becomes more transparent in those situations. That's an example of the sort of change this area signals. Can I also acknowledge that having Michael Barnes as Under-Secretary on the panel was massively significant. Health is complex. I think he saw the benefits of giving the system greater use of some levers in relation to having that sort of flexibility and also the use of sanctions, incentives and benefits in relation to supportive behaviour change. There is absolutely no doubt that unless sustainability drivers are put into the system, health funding will become totally unsustainable. The number we quoted in the report, if growth continued uncurtailed, it would be 38% of the budget. This report indicates that health has already made significant inroads, reducing its expenditure from 9%, an average of 9%, to an order of 2% in the last 2 years. But we argue very strongly for the need to look at the funding footprint, to have realistic consideration of demand, to have realistic consideration of the impacts in any government changes. Private health insurance is probably a good example, but also to have a look at the significant impact that changes in wages policy can have on the health budget. So you'll pick that discussion up there. In starting this review, the Premier made it quite clear that this is a period of budget stringency. So the review itself always considers opportunities to actually look at minimising future costs while at the same time actually improving the quality of care. Time doesn't permit me to go through each one of those, but I think you will get the sense and I'm happy to take questions. The digital space, such a space of opportunity, an area I think the Minister has quite rightfully indicated will require significant long-term commitment and investment. I know that there is always a challenge in relation to getting people to capture their data on a digital space, but I was shocked, for one, as someone who lives near three big teaching hospitals, that none of them had a set of records that could be transferred between hospitals. So in effect, every time, someone had to enter that data in again. Digital change in health means safety is a far easier reach. Transparency is a reach. Efficiency is a reach. You have some amazing clinicians here. You lead the area in genomics. You lead the area in so much work already in relation to data. It's making that data available to clinicians to make the best decisions, to people who use the system so they can make informed decisions. But we are talking about a long-term progression here of change. We've certainly in this instance included a target with the aim that system-wide that there be an EMR and that there be a staged and considered rollout across the health system. Culture and workforce. This, I would argue, workforce is the health's most significant asset, not its buildings, it's its workforce. We've given this a prominence which is necessary. We have focused at great length on the issue of culture. I noticed the Australian Medical Journal a while ago basically said that improvements in quality and safety, in terms of changing how the system operated behaviourally, was totally linked to parallel work and culture. You get it, I get it. Health is one of the hardest cultures in terms of how people treat each other in some instances. There is not a discussion that culture didn't come up in, but people also saw culture change as being one of the most significant levers to an ongoing sustainability agenda. But also to make health a place where people want to work in, because in effect that has been a significant driver of change in other areas. We've talked about capability. We've talked about the fact that the health and social care workspace is now the second biggest employer. The growth rate in this area is over 10%. And the issue is that unless health becomes a more proactive purchaser and indicates to both vocational and universities what its needs are, you'll get a basic mismatch between the health workforce and social care workforce that is coming out of our colleges and universities. So there are opportunities, I think, to formalise and to do it. People have said, but we've talked about doing this before. My answer quite simply is, for Christ's sake, do it. Start it. There are so many reasons that this is hard, but this is a pivotal piece of work to ensure that you have the employees and you yourself have the skills as leaders of the health system to take it forward. I think the recommendations are quite clear. Innovate for sustainability. The Minister's Future Fund, Health Research Future Fund, is a blessing. It also means it's an opportunity for health with the appropriate incentives to ensure that population health needs are actually captured in the research agenda, that there's greater focus actually on translating research into practice. But I, for one, I don't like a situation where I like WA looking at evidence base and looking at practice in other jurisdictions. You have such a proud history of leading in so many areas. I'd like to see WA lead the research agenda more, and I think the Minister has potentially identified a good source of funds. That's a very quick skip through the recommendations. Hopefully you'll have some questions to ask the other panel members, not me. Before finishing up, I want to say, clearly at the moment, a health CEO's performance agreement is probably about 30 pages of indicators about waiting times, efficiency of throughput, how many patients they've seen. Most of them have to do with the efficiency of the system. The clear message we heard from WACOS and from most groups we spoke to is success has to be redefined. We have identified quite different KPIs that need to go into a health CEO and into Russ's performance agreement. These align with the Premier's government recent priorities, but they are quite different. They ensure a different focus. They focus on the patient, the user experience. They put at the heart the experience of people who work in the system. They are our eyes and ears, and they drive the change. They will focus on health outcomes. Is it actually making a difference as opposed to how much money is being spent and could we spend it better in some other areas? Very clear focus on giving mental health the same status as in other areas. At the moment, that data is not collected in relation to mental health, and we've been quite explicit with Tim's direction and the input of the Mental Health Commissioner, and I think the 350 consumers and carers we met with make sure that we are become more visible in the system. Child health, issues such as avoidable hospitalisations, looking at a whole range of factors that actually have to do whether the system is actually succeeding. End of life, an area because it matters that much to most people at one point or other to actually look at whether we're getting change. Clinicians and consumers were as one on this page. Obesity, we have flagged two areas up front in the population health issues. Are we actually getting closer to healthy weights across the community? Quality and safety measures, I think the others I could run through. The financial measures are significant, but it indicates quite a redefinition of what constitutes success. Can I say, from having had these measures in so many of my performance agreements, they change your behaviour. Combined with the Premier's recent announcement of our priorities, they will change behaviour. All of a sudden, partnerships become more purposeful. The funding models will become quite differently redefined in what terms constitute success. So this is ultimately an important change in the health system operation. Quite finally, the Minister's flagged, and I'm very pleased to hear it, that there's some funding to facilitate the implementation steps. This is a long journey. We have actually identified some time horizons that recognise that the health leaders and you as leaders of the health and social care space need to have input in relation to the sequencing. The Cabinet has accepted our enduring strategies. The Cabinet has accepted our recommendations. We have given the latitude in implementation to get people to come up with better ways of achieving those directions, because the state of knowledge will actually change. But we have included a number of very specific priorities that need to be considered in implementation, because that's where the evidence base is, that's where the body of evidence and knowledge also is. So the question is, why not these in the first instance? Implementation, structured process, and I'm very pleased to hear that the Minister's made the first steps to announce the ministerial oversight group. I think that's an important way of ensuring that communication is also embedded in the system And I very much welcome the announcement of the appointment of Professor Hugo Massey-Clark. Hugo Massey-Taylor. Sorry, I'm getting old. I want to quite simply say again, thank you. This is your report. Its depth is a credit to the input that's gone into it. And I want to say simply thank you. The government's support of the recommendations is a vote of confidence in the system's ability to deliver, but also the fact that it represents the views of many. I really do want to applaud Dermot, and I want to say personally it's been an absolute pleasure working with you. Thank you.